This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat and welcome to Night School, the show that explores key themes in history, the social sciences and the humanities. Together with Sharat Kutan, we critically unpack theories, frameworks and social phenomena, the better to understand how society works. Each week we discuss a classic text, theme or an idea that we hope to shed light on the world around you. We can't have Sharat on this week, he's busy moving actually, but we have Punky Tech with us. You might recognize his voice, which is coming on soon, from previous episodes where you talked a lot about sexuality and citizenship. And I think there was one episode where we did two panels on love and freedom. But today, I want to pick your brain on the issue of our visual culture and the political implications of our visual culture, the social, broader, philosophical questions that it raises. Because I think we are at an interesting turning point culturally where our visual experience through social media, through advertising, through the expansion of these different communications technology is putting the act of viewing, gazing, visually evaluating at the forefront of, you know, our socializing, our values and so forth. What comes to mind when you think about this topic, Pang?
Okay, I'm very fascinated by what actually gets put into public and who gets the power to determine what gets put into the public, right? And also at the same time, then who is given the privilege and or the sense of entitlement that they have a say of who belongs in that public, or who gets seen in that public. Mm-hmm. So the whole idea of being seen, being part of the social imaginary, right? And as an extension of the social imaginary, to be entitled to produce and reproduce the visual culture, the symbols mm-hmm. of the imaginary, you know, all this becomes very interesting way of converging and condensing the powers around certain groups and certain people and certain elites. Mm-hmm, yeah, mm-hmm.
Yeah, because we have this rather false impression that all this is liberating, right? That we can, you know, post a photo of our food, of our vacations, of our selfies in the bathroom or living room where we get to choose the filter, we get to, you know, modify what we look like so that we become presentable. But what we're rather consciously or unconsciously succumbing to are social norms and standards, mm-hmm. right? And in the process, we are reinforcing those standards, which is why when we see what's happening right now, we also see the rise of controversies, right? So the typical controversy now is that if you're a Malay Muslim woman, you know, you have to appear a certain way. Yes, you can utilize this technology, but only according to, like you say, the script society and the power structure allows.
For me, one of the most interesting moments in my study of visual culture is actually looking at Victor Bergin's conception, right, of how, I mean, he was describing this debate between artists the debate between political art and non-political art. So he's saying that, I think he was coming at a point of the debate where people were arguing that art should not be political, because art that's political becomes propaganda, right? And I think this comes at the end of the social realist movement, or maybe even in the middle of it, you know, where artists reacting against abstraction, mm-hmm, yeah, mm-hmm.
Yes.
Saying that we need to art to reflect our realities, and so then there's this whole debate, right? Mm-hmm. You know, whether art should be political or not political. And Victor Bergin argues that actually that even the myth of turning away from politics, right? The idea that you can turn away from politics requires daily practice of turning away mm-hmm. that in itself then constitute a form of politic, right? The idea that you've turned this into a practice is actually just a way of saying, okay, I will not look at this issue, and in order not to look at this issue, I will look elsewhere, mm-hmm. right? So what is it you're looking at? Who designed those products? Who mm-hmm. designed those sceneries for you to look at while you're not looking at politics. And that space that has been created for you to look at to distract you from looking at politics is also a product of politics. Yeah. So it's very interesting for me to think of our act of looking away as also actually deliberate.
This is very interesting, and I want you to unpack this a little bit for us. So the idea is that we are already in a way conditioned to look and ignore, that these things are not necessarily something that we consciously decide without any political implications.
I mean, so imagine, right, these days that we have a camera, right? So we see something nice, we like it, a cute, mostly a cat, I guess. anything cute, a cat, beautiful sceneries, poor people by the street with beautiful lines on their faces. So there's all this idea that we are making these choices to point our cameras in these directions. But I'm questioning and I'm wondering whether this act of pointing the camera, this act of choosing our subjects is actually not in itself constituted by the act of not looking at something else, right? So it's about is how actually our preferences are not always just shaped by the pull, but also the push.
Right.
Something needs to repel us in order to confirm or cohere our desires towards what it needs to desire. Right? So I'm also thinking then, if this is true for what we look at and what we photograph, then how much of what we end up photographing is actually an act of not looking at something else?
Right. So there is something that's excluded. There's something that that's in turn unseen and left out of the conversation, left out of the discourse. I'm thinking about my own experience as well because, you know, now about 5 or 6 years into using Facebook, and it's taken so much political currency, right? Politicians use it. Controversies are started by it. I'm becoming a bit more weary, you know, sometimes of posting things that might actually offend certain family members. And of course, now the safe choice would be cute furry animals and stuff like that. But after a while, it becomes habit. I avoid these things and I choose these things. And in a lot of ways, I create a false atmosphere that is really more selectively towards these so-called safe topics when in fact, you know, a socially more socially responsible attitude to it would be to push discussions on things that are more important.
Or therefore, even discussions on cute furry animals and why we like it and what are we investing in when we post these pictures, right? It goes down to the same idea of why, for example, the US passport, every page is full of sceneries of American landscape, right?
Yes.
Because I think at that level also, right, the idea pulls along the fact that you are, how do I say this? That what you end up looking at is also an act of mastery over that subject, right?
Yes.
Over that view. So it's never just the object you're looking at, you know? It's also the sense that you're given that you are the looker, right? You are the looker and the looker has this power over what he sees. In some ways, all these different notes, you know, from trying not to look at something because it either disempowers us or confuses us or actually it's just really not encouraged for us to look at it. And looking at something that is safe because it grants us this power. The economy of the of what is available to look at determines also actually our place in that visual culture. Yeah.
You know, you're a curator, you're an activist, you're a photographer. What, based on your works in these different spheres, what have you found to be difficult to portray or to represent or depict? Some of the more difficult choices you've had to make in that process.
So actually, I'll turn it around a little bit. I don't think my question has always been about what is difficult to portray, but actually where it is difficult to present what you want to portray. In a sense, everybody has, at some point of their life, probably taken photos of themselves that they wouldn't show to the public, right?
Yeah.
To exchange with, you know, people they want to exchange that with. And so that there is a lot of self-portrayal going on.
Yes.
Anyway, regardless of how much of it you see, or maybe, you know, or what we end up seeing are the headless ones. So
Yeah.
But the idea is that I think we are, there's a lot of obsession with the self, and obsession with the private sphere, or what we can do in the private sphere, and what we should in the private sphere that remains in the private sphere. So I think one of the interesting way of thinking about this is, what is allowed to be put in the gallery?
Mm-hmm.
What is allowed to be put in a public space? If you look at the controversies of art in Malaysia, it's usually not only about the subject matter. It is about the subject matter in that space.
Mm.
Who gave permission to put that piece of work in that space? How can we allow that portrayal of that kind of religion, of that portrayal of that kind of sexuality to be put in this public space?
Mm-hmm.
If this is the tension, right, I think then the interesting strategy is not about portrayal, because the point, as I was making, right, is we are led to believe that we are free to portray and shoot what we want to shoot. And so we are always seduced by the idea that shooting something, photographing a selfie, a cat, our private parts, gives us and accords us this freedom, right? The mm-hmm. freedom in choosing yes. this yeah. sort of subjects and objects. But actually, the freedom is limited where you are allowed to show it, mm. where you can show it. And so you police yourself according to the visual order of the social imaginary of the country. And you tell us, and you police yourself along where you think you're allowed to show these subjects. So I think good and interesting artworks are those that actually rupture
the spatial divisions,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Of what goes in there, mm-hmm. you know? And then the productive questions that come out of that is actually, who decides on what goes into the public spaces?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And why have we internalized their decision? The phrase that I like from your account is you're self-policing, right? That even before it's announced, even before, you know, the state apparatus talks to you, you're already internalizing the logic, right? Where is this safe? Where is this appropriate? That shows how effective the structure is, right? Yeah. When it's inhabiting our psyche. One of the implications in here is that we've become really neurotic, right? Because on one hand, we have this experience, like you say, of mastery, right? The technology is free most of the time. You just download the app. Mm. And you have, like you said, the act of looking becomes the act of controlling, right? You can choose the filter. You can crop. You can modify, you can modify the original image. We've all become mini Andy Warhols in a way, right? And then we can replicate it and it becomes shared on social media. But at the same time, there's also this, whether we realize it or not, internal self-policing. What are we becoming in the process? How are we mutating? Or what are we mutating into, you know? We're locked in these two different experiences.
I don't know. I think we are mutating to an extension of our technology. we are becoming, I think, we are left to just accept the spaces that were given to us and the things that are given to us to look and to which we are given pleasure. All right, I think if you even want to go as far as pulling in Laura Mulvey's idea of the male gaze, right, mm-hmm. and the visual pleasure that we are taught to derive from, or that men are taught to derive from looking at women in a certain way, mm-hmm. and deriving pleasure from the act of being the subject looking at the object,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Or actually how that's an extension of the human desire to assume that we own what we look at,
mm-hmm,
you
mm-hmm.
know, and therefore we don't own what we don't look at,
mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm,
and mm-hmm. or we turn away from what we cannot own.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think there's that kind of tension. It does exist, you know, because I've seen a photo exhibition in Malaysia. God bless them; they're great people. But it was called Gorilla Exhibition, right? So the idea is that they're going to provide a space in a public space in the mall. People will just go and stick photograph on it or whatever they want.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a caveat: no politics.
Mm. Right,
you know, and it's called the Gorilla Exhibition.
Yeah.
I mean, the irony is so interesting that it's actually about space. It's about space,
interesting,
and about what we are not looking at, and therefore we cannot bring the two together. You know, the things that we are not looking at also is the things that we cannot represent.
Rosa Luxemburg has this very interesting quote, and I think somehow it ties into this discussion. She said, "You won't know how free you are unless you move." And I think space has a lot to do with that, right? Like, we don't really know how free we are, how unfree we are. We don't know where we can't go or what we can't do at certain spaces, you know, because mobility, the idea to go, to move, to pursue the activities where you want it to be, is very key to, you know, how we construe freedom. And I think the visual ties into it, to this very, very interestingly, as you say. But we have to take a break right now. But we'll come back more on this discussion. One of the things I want to touch on is the whole idea of shame and shaming, how this ties into it. But for now, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, joined this week by Pang Ki Teh, and you're listening to Night School on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to Night School. This is Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, joined this week by activist, curator, Pang Ki Teh. And we're discussing the politics of the visual, or the politics of our visual culture and our increasing reliance and bonding with visual technology to depict ourselves, to portray the world, and the limitations therein. One of the things that's emerged as a result is a culture of shaming. Right, and this could be something as innocuous as bad parking, right? There's a car that parks at the disabled parking lot, and we take the photo of the car. Sometimes the person is there. We see the license plate, and then we ask people to share it. Right, let's shame this person into behaving better, you know. But we see, I guess, more disturbing manifestations of this when certain women are picked on for the way they dress, for the way they color their hair, or the way they behave. There are two narratives here. On one hand, there's a very superficial people power narrative going on. We can call out the bad guys. We can shame politicians, petty criminals. But at the same time, it's also brought out the worst in us. We're nitpicking on what people wear and how they behave. What do you see in this process? What's going on here?
We are confronted, right, by how little power we have every day, you know, and every little bit of power that we derive from our technology, we like to use it because, I mean, and this power is can come from actually anything from, you know, photographing someone who wronged us, or just writing about it and posting on Facebook anonymously, even or. Recently threatening to rape people whose views of Islam disagrees with us. So I think that's it confers a sense of entitlement and power. But what is also very interesting about it is actually when people do this, I think they're also thinking of their public, right? Their readers. And there's a certain confidence that they're taking that what they're doing is being seen. And being seen by the people who agrees with them. And I take an example, Kiki with her steering lock.
Yeah.
Right? When Kiki...
Just to remind our listeners, it was an instance of road rage that was photographed. Videoed, yeah, basically, where Kiki, a very, I guess, outspoken, spirited Malay woman, threatened to beat up an old Chinese uncle, and it became very racialized, and it was national news. Anyway, go on.
No, so she was holding her
steering lock,
right? Yep. So if I'm not mistaken, I think at some point in the video, after she threatened the uncle, right, she actually turned away, and she went back to her car. She looked at her audience and said, "Sebab dia Cina." That remark is very interesting for me because there is a certain confidence that she has taken in her public. Right? This act wouldn't have been possible, I think, if she hadn't had the confidence in her audience.
Yes.
Right? And what is that audience then? That is a very interesting question. Is that audience really who those people are there? Or, more interestingly, who these people are supposed to represent?
Right?
So, in a way, she's relying on a social imaginary that has been so carefully curated for us, you know, in Malaysia, of who owns the power, of who confers the right to threat, threaten, right? And so when she does that, she's taking in, I think, not just the immediate actual people on the ground, but the idea of the public space, the idea of the public audience, at everybody who's looking at her as a legitimization.
Correct.
Of this act. So I think when we do that, when we post these things on Facebook, we are also relying on that same, we believe, rage or entitlement that our audience will agree with us and share in solidarity with us. It's also then about doing something that we feel already belong in that public sphere, in that script.
Yeah.
You know, that we can perform and get away with and be safe in assuming.
It's the projections that happen in the process that I find very interesting, you know, because I think she was very confident in her actions and in her message, but and of course this backfired in several ways, one against her, but also against the act of calling this out, because eventually she joined Perkasa. So the shaming didn't really get her to feel the right kind of remorse or get her into the right kind of reflective process. You know, it just in a way solidified her commitment to her indignation, right, in racial terms. We've mentioned a lot about this, and I'm on the same page with you when it comes to the important question of who dictates the public, right? Who gets to shape public life? Because in a democracy, public life should not be monopolized by any one agenda. But let's unpack this a bit more. I find personally that there is even a public and private distinction, a problem, right? How do we critically unpack this division? Because on one hand, it's a necessary defense. We need the private sphere, right? But we don't want to reify it either. We don't want to overrate it either, right? And sometimes the libertarian narrative is all about that, right? The privacy is so great. You know, we have to, safeguard private spaces, which is true, but not at the expense of losing public power, right? So how do we unpack this division critically? Yeah.
You know, when we look back to how John Stuart Mill formulated the idea of the private as the space a safe space from the state, intrusion, right? Mm-hmm. That this is the private is the space in which we can develop and nurture our subjectivities, you know, without the influence of the state. And I think this assumption actually reinforces the power of the state, because we are merely drawing a line to say, okay, the state's power stops here, right? Mm-hmm. But it doesn't question the state's power,
right?
Yeah, it accepts that the state has power over us, except beyond this line.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, even the line is porous, as we know, right? Yep. It's an illusion.
It's arbitrary.
So they'll come in again if they think that you are performing close proximity, sexual deviance. And all kinds of things give them excuse to go over this line. Yet, I think we are seduced by this line because the neoliberal discourse has actually enabled us to imagine it as a physical space.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the moment the space that is abstracted in John Mill's conception of privacy... It's not all abstract. I think he does talk about domestic spaces. But I think the fact that we have kind of made it a physical space, where the boundary is at our door, right? We lose the notion that this space, or rather we lose the notion that we actually have to a degree some amount of control over defining these spaces, of how public and how private or how mixed they are, right? So we surrender that in order for us to have a private space that is physical, that's demarcated by the door, the walls around our home, and padded by IKEA furniture, right?
Yeah.
So that we can go mad in it and not hurt ourselves. I think we are told that therefore, if we invest our attention and our time and our money in creating this space, we buy things, we make more money to protect it and buy insurance over it.
Yeah.
Yeah. The more, in fact, so the wealthier we get, the safer that space becomes.
Yep. Yep.
And it's true to a degree.
Yep.
Right. That therefore, people who are richer tends to feel the effects of discrimination or oppression in a lesser degree.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, they get some insurance against also the inequalities of the world. Yeah.
Because they can afford insurance.
So I draw that line because I think once we do that, right? Once we do that, then the next step happens, which is that we then invest we then create also that line to divide our visual representation of ourselves, you know, so that in the public we want to represent ourselves in a way that fit into the public visual order.
Mm-hmm.
The visual order, there's an idea of a certain order of things.
Yeah.
Right? That the state dictates for us. So we want to be placed in there that doesn't seem disruptive of that space in order to earn our right to have the private space.
Right.
Yeah. So we play along with the idea of who we are, where we are in public, so that we will not be seen. Actually, correct. The idea is self-invisibilization.
Interesting.
Yeah? We want to become so part of the public that we become invisible that we can then retreat into the private to do what we want and get away with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, correct me if I'm wrong, I want to rephrase this because I think this is a very interesting point. We conform in order to buy the legitimacy of who we are so that we will not be disturbed in private.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that we appear to everyone as safe enough as to not trigger any suspicions because we are such radically different people in private spheres.
And then you have Facebook. Which is a very... So the internet is this very strange, interesting space that we both exert our private self in a kind of a public forum.
Yeah.
Right? It's like... So in a way, it's like gardening, right?
Mm-hmm.
A garden is like a very public space to express a very private dream, right?
Yep. So, interesting analogy. Yeah.
Yeah. So we curate it. We manicure this garden. We put the kind of flowers we want there and the kind of
animals we want.
Yeah. Animals we want. So and I think in a way it's still playing, you know, with what we want to be seen, how we want to be seen.
Yes.
And of course we allow a bit of looseness there. And it gives us yet another way of thinking about how we control the defining of this space. And the state comes in and clearly panics over this space called the internet.
Yes.
And the fact that I think the state wants to charge people for sedition for what they post on the internet is clearly the state's attempt at saying, excuse me, this is still public.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
This is public and therefore I have power over this. Yeah. We have power over this.
Yeah.
Whereas people are saying, no, I'm sorry, this is private and you know. So there's that contestation that's happening over the internet because it's still, I think, an unmarked territory.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. My training is in philosophy. I'm into virtues given these confines that we're in. You know, how do we be true to ourselves? How do we nurture the best, the healthiest form of outlook towards people? Because I think the implication in what you're sharing here is that we're becoming very radically divided selves as a result of not just our dependence on these visual technologies, but how they're politicized. And in this process, as we are explaining what's going on, I'm thinking of my own situation. And I do see how I internalize the state's logic sometimes. I do see how I conform to social scripts. But how do we be courageous as ourselves authentically at the face of all these constraints?
You know, I don't have no solution for that because my life, my activism actually is... It's really, I find very timid, right? And so occasionally I be marked with anger and righteous indignation and I'll post something and immediately I start to second guess myself.
Right? Yeah.
And I say, oh my God, is that safe? Should I have said it that way?
Yep.
And if, I mean, my posts are all famous for having at least 4 or 5 edits.
and they can see the edits too. If they bother, they can look at how it changed.
I mean,
right?
I don't mind leaving that, but the fact that is I will keep editing it until I feel it's safe or it says what I want. Another strategy I end up doing is I call my friends that I trust, right? Or I post this to my friend. And you have been a subject to this panic before.
It's interesting social analysis, right? Yeah, go on.
That, you know, that I then send to some of my friends, say, do you think this is safe? And I rely on then my friends to be a kind of a gauge for me to see whether what I'm expressing here is going to get me into trouble and if that trouble is going to be worth getting into.
Mm.
And I think at the end of the day, that's the line I draw. Is this trouble worth getting into and how many people are willing to get into it with me? And I think what I've done instinctively is to build a community of people who look out for each other in that way and or people who I can trust to tell me... you know, if this is okay. And of course, I think one of the myths that we like to believe is that we should always be free to express what we want to express, right? Mm-hmm. And that this is fundamentally the argument of people who champion freedom of expression above all else. Mm-hmm. That ultimately, it's I shouldn't self-censor. But I'm now thinking, actually, sometimes it's not about self-censoring, right? It's actually about finding the best way to say this thing that makes the most impact, or the to communicate it in a way to reach the audience I want it to reach.
Yeah, and it's a question of strategy as much as principles.
Yeah, yeah. So rather than saying that it's self-censoring, I sometimes think of it as modulating the message a bit. Mm-hmm. You know, changing the key it's written in and the tone. Because I think sometimes you really just want to offend somebody, and you think that that's going to be a worthwhile exercise, mm-hmm. because you're confident that the majority of your audiences are going to be on your side, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. But I think if we build a kind of idea that we are never totally alone, and we also and that ourselves are in constant interaction with people around us, and that the society we want to build is actually should be modeled after that interaction, mm-hmm. yeah, rather than that self, because then that's not society, you see. Because if we are talking about modeling society, then the model should be about our should be made through the interaction we make with others, and so I think it's okay that I ask my friends, and it's okay that I'm constantly impatient or angry, but I have people around me to remind me, okay, Pang, you're being impatient, just. Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. cool down off. Or Pang, maybe you shouldn't post this right now.
Yeah, yeah.
Or you should go ahead. You know, but maybe you want to say it this way. You know,
yeah.
So this is ultimately, I still hold the responsibility because I am the one who posted it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
And I accept that. But before I do that, I'm happy. I'm very happy to actually sometimes ask my friends and say, "Is it okay?" Mm-hmm. And this actually has also then allowed me to post political things, things that I've been told I shouldn't be saying in public. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's about sexuality or LGBTs or politics, racial politics even. So first, I think I do it by bringing it into my kind of a small public, you know, of my friends, know, and then bringing it to a bigger public.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the camaraderie is very important because you got to realize that when the message goes out there, it no longer becomes about you, but become also about the themes that are touched upon. So if it's race, if it's politics, if it's sexuality, the implications are always bigger. People will relate, they will become hostile. And I think having people who we can turn to for insights on how to improve the discussion, how to word certain things properly, is a healthy part of that dialogue. Unfortunately, we've reached the end of the show now, Pang. We do welcome recommendations for texts. And you mentioned some names that are very interesting there that maybe you want to recommend to our listeners?
Well, I did mention Victor Bergin. Mm-hmm. I really forgot the title of that essay, but you can find it in most visual culture readers. Mm-hmm. And it's, I think, on photography, I think, if I'm not wrong. And of course, I that's a good start for looking at how the visual culture becomes politicized and how the act of apoliticization is an act of it's a political act as well, and therefore you're always when you look away and do other things, he's basically saying you are reinforcing this politics of the neoliberal spaces that you end up having.
You know, that's a very interesting point, and I was going to raise it before, but it slipped my mind. This idea of looking away is very innocuous, right? But it has such profound implications. Like, say we're eating at Mama, and then we get a beggar coming. And then we really literally look away. Mm. We ignore that person's there, you know. But if you just capture that moment and see what the underlying messages are or the overtones are, it is political, the act of looking away in those moments. So you're right. I think one of the takeaways from this discussion is pay attention to what you're not paying attention to, right? Or look at what you resist looking at.
Yeah. And also look at the thing that you're already looking at and ask yourself, are these things there to buy your attention and distract you from something else?
Very, very interesting. Speaking of visual culture readers, I have one in mind. It's edited by Nicholas Mirzoff.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
Yeah.
That's the one.
It's this one, right? Yeah. It's by Routledge, and I think it's gone through various editions by now. And I've turned to it during some of my social theory courses, and it's a great overview of some of the things we've talked about today. In any case, Pang, are you on Twitter?
Not so active on Twitter, but yes, you know, Pangkitek, PangKheeTeik.
Okay, you can reach Pang there, and email us at bfmnightschool@gmail.com if you have any comments or questions on this topic, and we can forward it to him or share it to everyone else. Anyway, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat as usual, and this week we had Pangkitek, and this has been Night School on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.